Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show today, well, 90% chance we'll have Eric Margolies here. I'm thinking to talk about what's going on in Palestine. Man, did you guys spend all weekend looking at the news out of Gaza too? What a weekend ruiner that's been. Anyway, pretty fitting for a work day, I guess, around here. Horror show, absolute horror show out of Palestine these last few weeks. Margolies on to talk about that. He's got a brand new one out here at uns.com. Israel's 155mm cure for terrorism. Yeah. And then Joshua Hughes, he's a fan of the show, who's emailed me to explain that he's now an American expat. He's fled on down to South America, Latin America, as so many of us have contemplated in the past, at least, right? And got a farm down there. And he's decided he's going on a hunger strike, not till the end of the bombing campaign, but until the end of the siege of the Gaza Strip, which is pretty drastic. But he's a serious guy, and I'm going to let him on the show to have his say. Today on the show, Joshua Hughes on his hunger strike for the people of Palestine. Now, what's he supposed to do, you know? I don't know. I don't know what to do. It's funny, you know, I think to myself, man, I ought to get out there with a sign that says, like, hey, leave Palestine alone, dude, or something. And then I think, well, you know, you got the show, and I guess the show is, you know, the best you can do. What's standing outside with a sign going to do? I don't know. I mean, I guess if you can get a huge enough crowd to all stand with signs with you, then it's kind of a thing. But what's any of us supposed to do about it? I don't know. That's why I do a radio show, because I don't know what to do about any of it. So I do this. And I work more than full-time for antiwar.com, even though I got laid off from there 3 years ago or whatever. 2 years ago. It's the most important project on the internet. So that's what I know to do about it, which is, you know, it's not the answer. It's the stand-in for an answer. Anyway, thanks for tuning in to my stand-in for an answer of what to do about it. And by the way, thank you, everybody, who's a regular listener to this show. As I'm sure you're all well aware, support for this show, or interest in this show, I should say, is about a foot wide and a mile deep. There are very few of you who are interested. But apparently, from the response I get, those of you who like it really get it and really dig it. And so, you know, I'd have quit a long time ago if I didn't get messages like that all the time, because I sure as hell ain't in it for the money. If only there were money to be in it for. Maybe I would be, but you know, it is. I do have a comparative advantage and all, but no, it ain't the money. But anyway. So today on the show, bad news and a couple of good interviews. And I got a lot more invites out. I know everybody is just completely swamped. Everybody I'm interested in trying to get on the show is just completely swamped today. Oh, you know what? I could talk to this guy. I just got an email from the Institute for Public Accuracy. They do a pretty good job of putting out, you know, people available for interviews. Man, I do want to interview. I do want to talk to this guy. I know we're friends on Twitter, too. Ken Klippenstein. Do you know him, guys? He wrote this thing for, you can follow him on Twitter. He wrote a thing for Truth Out all about what America pays the Israelis. the equipment the American government gives them to kill Palestinians with. Very important stuff. Very good stuff. I'm going to email him at the break. See if I can add him to the short list of interviewees here today. All right. So now enough talking. Get to the news, Horton. You know what? Let me talk about the Oklahoma City bombing first, just because I got to get it out of the way for today. There's a trial going on. This is so huge. This is such a big deal. I'll say it as fast as I can, all right? Summer of 1995, the feds murder a man in prison named Kenneth Trenadue. 90% chance what was going on there was it was mistaken identity. They thought he was a man named Richard Lee Guthrie, and they tortured him to death, beat him to death, for refusing to come off with all the information they wanted out of Richard Guthrie, but that he didn't have because he wasn't him. Well, Kenneth's brother, the victim's brother, is a lawyer named Jesse Trenadue. And so instead of the government just bulldozing him and getting away with murder, he fought back by filing court papers on deadline and whooping their ass. And he's found this judge in Utah who apparently does not love the Department of Justice and whose attitude is, do what I say. I'm a judge, and you're nothing but the government. And so, you know, I'm not all that into popular sovereignty, but I do like that kind of thing. Little bit of a check and balance. And this judge is now letting Jesse Trenadue's Freedom of Information Act lawsuit go to trial over, he says, there's plenty of evidence that the government possesses surveillance footage of the Oklahoma bombing that they've never released. And boy, is he right that there is plenty of evidence that they, at least at one time, had that footage, even if they've destroyed it since. But maybe not. And he is now suing for the right to go through the FBI's documents and files and evidence and look for it himself, since they keep pretending they can't find it. And I think it's very likely that he's going to win this trial. And as Jesse always puts it, he set out to get justice for his little brother. For his brother. It's not his fault that the reason that the government murdered him is because they thought he was Timothy McVeigh's buddy John Doe 2, accomplice in the Oklahoma City bombing. It's not Jesse's fault that his brother's murder is tied into the cover-up of the murder of 169 people on April 19th, 1995. But that's the way it is. And he's making real progress. And now, in this most groundbreaking sense, he is going to trial. And so the Associated Press and CBS and a few others are finally picking up on this and saying, I wonder if there's extra footage of that bombing we don't know. And now you know where I'm going with this. You see the whole thing here, John Doe 2? Remember John Doe 2 that doesn't exist, according to the FBI? Does exist. At least did exist. And I'm not 100% certain. There are different versions of the story. I think it's most likely that Richard Guthrie, the man that Kenneth Trenadue was most likely mistaken for, was John Doe number 2 in the Ryder truck with McVeigh the morning of the bombing. I think there's also a chance that it was Michael Brescia or a couple of other closer suspects. There's also reason to believe that Peter Langen, another neo-Nazi, was there with them, helping that morning. Not so much directing traffic, but I guess letting them know that a space had opened up. Come on, guys, whatever. Anyway, there's a brand new book about it. It's not brand new. It's a year old. It's called Oklahoma City, What the Investigation Missed and Why It Matters. And this is just straight journalism. It is not conspiracy theory crap at all. And as an ex-conspiracy theory crappist from back in the 90s and whatever, I hate that crap. But that's not what this is. This is just straight journalism. And it's about how the Nazis did it and the FBI and the DOJ covered it up because they were all compromised informants and flip states witnesses. And so murderers of 169 people got away with it. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Unfortunately, Eric will only be able to join us for 10 minutes today, but that's all right. I want to hear 10 minutes of Eric Margulies on what's going on in Gaza right now. Don't you? Me too. Oh, man. And, you know, all right, well, whatever. So, the news is that they bombed a playground. The Israelis bombed a playground this morning with a drone. A playground at a refugee camp inside the refugee camp that is Gaza in the first place. Come on, man. What in the... Strikes near Gaza's Shifa Hospital, refugee camp, kill or hurt 30, including at least 10 children. There's pictures this morning all over Twitter of tiny little children's lifeless bodies. I don't know the total number of children. The highest number I've seen late, let me see, antiwar.com's latest is 1,139 people killed. I don't know exactly how many of those are kids, but so many of them. And there's this article that was out yesterday. I think it was at Vox. Data journalism. And they said, how come so many of the dead in Gaza are children? Which, because the Israelis keep bombing them, that's why. That's the real answer, but, oh, okay, I see you're being more specific than that. It's because the population of Gaza is so young. As they put it, if you just shot an artillery shell toward Gaza City, chances are about 50-50 you'd kill a kid. They're everywhere. The median age there is 18. And I'm sorry, because the way the statistics are broken down, they're never, complete. But at least one thing said that 40% of the people in the Gaza Strip, 40% are under the age of 14. So, you go to war there, you kill kids. And this is after they're bombing this UN school. First, they admitted it. Yeah, we bombed the school. It's their fault for being Hamas, blah, blah. And they said, oh, no, we didn't bomb the school. It was Hamas who bombed the school. For days, they tried to say that. Even though all the witnesses, including foreign journalists on the scene, said, no, it was the Israelis who did it. But, just enough to confuse the issue. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's a transparent lie. Those who can be fooled all the time will be and will repeat it. Every PR troll on the internet will have a new talking point, just enough to confuse the issue for a little while longer. Killed 16 people, most of them children. And now, as antiwar.com reports, they admit that they fired at the school, but say they didn't kill anyone. UN admits... Israel admits shelling UN school in Gaza, claims no one killed. The Israeli spokesman actually came out and said, no, the locals must have just brought a bunch of dead bodies to the scene. Right? Like the Ukrainian rebel who said, oh no, all the bodies from this plane crash were all already dead and drained of blood. Really, huh? Oh, why don't you tell me some more lies, Israeli government? Israel admits shelling UN school in Gaza, bizarrely claims no one killed. At least 16 confirmed dead by locals. And they've released this footage of them bombing an empty parking lot. And they're saying, see, here we are bombing an empty parking lot. Yeah, so? Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Why don't you show me the rest of the video where you keep bombing the place until 16 people are dead? Whatever. Anyway, and then this morning, they bombed a playground. They bombed a playground in a refugee camp. And they tried to lie again and say, oh, it was Hamas rockets malfunctioned and hit the refugee camp playground. Yeah, nice lie, except for, uh-oh, NBC News has a reporter on scene who saw the drone do it. Which makes the Israelis, again, liars. And murderers of helpless little children. Now, you might ask yourself, but I'm a decent human being, and if I was in the Israeli military, I might shoot Hamas fighters, but I would never deliberately target children, and so therefore, it just couldn't possibly be true that the Israeli government would deliberately target children, because what kind of monsters would they have to be to do such a thing? So it must have been some kind of malfunction, if not an outright lie, right? That's how people rationalize in their brain. But here's the thing about it. Here's what kind of monster you have to be. You could be anybody. You know, Israel is nothing but the Milgram experiment writ large. Can you get people to commit acts of evil as long as someone else is telling them it's okay? The answer is yes. And, you know, compare for a moment, if you will, Madeleine Albright to Condoleezza Rice. Now, in the truest sense of the term, Madeleine Albright murdered, I don't know exactly how you break it down. Well, here's how I break it down. How do you break it down? Condoleezza Rice deliberately lied the country into an outright invasion that saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people killed, maybe even as much as a million, in a massive civil war that she started as national security advisor. Madeleine Albright, to the, you know, average person, wasn't that bad, right? Bill Clinton's Secretary of State. I don't remember any major wars during that time. But she oversaw the sanctions regime against Iraq. There's a great clip which I had missed, or maybe I had forgotten about. Something tells me maybe I had seen this way back when. But there's a clip of Bill Richardson also saying the exact same thing as her, basically ratifying Madeleine Albright's statement that yes, even if half a million Iraqi children were killed in the blockade of the 1990s, so what? The price is worth it. We had a policy, and it was a good policy, Richardson says. Albright says the same thing. And so, as you already know, the policy was then, it was stated to be, they're trying to make life so miserable for the average Iraqi that they would rise up and overthrow Hussein. It was the technocratic thing to do, right? The banality of evil, see? You don't have to be a monster. You just have to be a government employee. And you can target children on playgrounds in Gaza for the greater good. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm joined on the phone now by Eric Margolies. He's covered more than a dozen wars around the world for decades now. He's the author of American Raj, Liberation or Domination. He writes at uns.com, at lourockwell.com, at ericmargolies.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Eric?
I'm glad to be back with you, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. So just talk to me about Gaza. You got 10 minutes. Say whatever you want.
Well, this this horrible situation is continuing without relent. The death toll is, I don't know what it's at. And at this moment, it's heading towards 2,000 dead, most of whom are civilians, 70% of whom are civilians, women and children. Israel is continuing to pound Gaza with U.S.-supplied weapons, 155-millimeter heavy howitzers, F-16s dropping bombs, helicopter gunships, all in violation of U.S. law for their use against civilians. Israel, I don't know what Israel is trying to completely liquidate Hamas or force it to bend its knee and agree to obey Israel. Hamas is dug in and is fighting a last-ditch fight for survival, hoping that if it can survive this attack, that it will regain a lot of its stature and may be able to break at least part of the 8-year Israeli blockade of Gaza.
Mm-hmm. And, well, what do you think, how do you think the war's playing out so far as, you know, in that context of whether Hamas is going to survive and thrive?
Well, you know, we really shouldn't call it a war. It's, I mean, I do, you,
right,
you
yeah.
do, but it's, it is a killing. It's reprisals against civilians. Both sides are doing it. The Palestinians are very foolish, in my opinion, in firing these rockets, which are absolutely useless except to make them feel good. They are less lethal than stones being thrown. All they do is get the Israelis madder and give Israel a pretext to go and pound the hell out of Gaza. Israel's real objective here is not all this baloney one hears about tunnels and rockets and things like that. Netanyahu, the very far right-wing leader of Israel, his plan is to completely thwart, collapse, stymie any attempts to create a Palestinian state. He said it repeatedly. There's no reason not to believe him. By stomping on Gaza and killing so many Palestinians, he's making sure that the Palestinians will be unlikely to be able to make a deal with him, and he's terrorized Israelis into thinking that any Palestinian state, a mini state on the West Bank, would be another Gaza showering rockets onto Israel. So he's been very successful in derailing U.S. and international and U.N. plans to create an independent Palestinian state, which is, as everybody knows, the solution to the problem.
Well, it sounds like he'd rather have the problem. He wants to keep Hamas there because what does he think he's doing? Fighting for, I mean, obviously he doesn't think he's fighting to install Fatah in power in Gaza, because that would make it even worse as far from his point of view, as far as the, you know, international legitimacy of the Palestinian Authority in seeking a Palestinian state.
Well, it
so
would,
he's just killing a bunch of kids for nothing, really.
Well, and Israeli soldiers, too. The Fatah, run by Mahmoud Abbas, is a sock puppet for the Americans and the Israelis. It's completely useless. This whole episode has shown that another sock puppet for Washington, the Ban Ki-moon, the mouse-like head of the UN, is also useless. So Netanyahu's calling the shots, and he knows he can do whatever he wants because he controls the U.S. Congress and much of the media.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, so I'm still just trying, and maybe it's the wrong thing to try to understand Netanyahu's plan from a reasonable point of view or whatever, but it doesn't seem like he's eradicating Hamas. In any insurgency, all they have to do is not be completely eradicated and they win. And so they'll come out as the champions of the underdogs, at least in Gaza, at the end of this. And the whole policy, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, is he not trying to deliberately kill civilians in order to turn the population against Hamas? And is that not a complete failure?
That may be part of the plan, no doubt about it. We Americans did that in Iraq. We tried
right,
to
yeah.
bomb them and starve them and blow up their sewage systems to try and get them to overthrow.
But Eric, it just seems obvious that Hamas is going to benefit from this in every way rather than lose. I mean, the ones that don't die in it, but organization.
As you just suggested earlier, still having Hamas there is not necessarily a negative for Israel, because Netanyahu can keep saying these Arab beasts, right, these wild beasts, saying, look, Hamas, they're terrorists, tunnels and terrorist children, etc.
So really it is just an exercise in mowing the grass, as they call it. Diminishing the power of Hamas a little bit, maybe tricking them into releasing their store rockets for a little while, or that kind of thing, and then just we'll do this again in a year and a half.
Hamas has got to be running out of rockets, I don't know how much longer it can really take these civilian casualties. The Israelis are making the rubble bounce now in Gaza. There's been total devastation, violating every tenet of international law. And look what the Arab states have done. For example, Egypt is complicit in Israel's attack on the Gaza civilians, because it's locking up the back door to Gaza and is cooperating with the Israelis to try and crush, stamp the life out of the Gaza resistance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've noticed that all the pro-Israel arguments are just complete nonsense, based on the premise that somehow, the Gaza Strip is the massive armed aggressor against poor little Israel surrounded by enemies. This kind of nonsense. Everyone else who's looking at the reality of the situation is opposed to the to what's going on there, and it makes me wonder if the Americans, it's really only the Americans who are falling for this crap, and it seems like if we can continue, the American people can continue being fooled into supporting this kind of thing, that we really are putting ourselves in danger of further terrorist attacks against the United States. He started this interview saying, yeah, they're killing them with our F-16s, bombing them and shooting them with our M-16s, and that's not going unnoticed here.
There will be another 9/11 type attack for sure, because there's so many people around the world. You're right. Americans and Canadians, let's say North Americans, have a cockeyed view of what's going on. All you have to do is watch French TV or German TV or Italian TV or any foreign TVs to services or read the papers, and you won't get this idea of tiny little Israel being attacked by 100 million bestial Arabs. They're reporting this fury against the United States around the world, but our media has filtered that out and is completely reporting the Israeli narrative developed by a bunch of PR experts and lawyers in New York.
Yeah, I saw where Lindsey Graham said, I guess the UN is just becoming anti-Semitic. Like, yeah, that's all this is about, is just the bigotry of the 7 billion people in the world who aren't Jews. They just all wake up in the morning hating Jews for no reason at all, I guess. That must be what's going on here.
Well, this is generating anti-Semitism around the world, which is terrible. And Israel bears a significant responsibility for this.
Yeah, well, and of course, things are getting pretty bad in France. There's been, I saw some clips this morning on TV of, riots and people chanting, supposedly at least, chanting death to the Jews, that kind of thing. That's worse than it's been in Europe in a long time, isn't it?
It is. France has the largest Jewish population in Europe, followed by Ukraine. And it's opening old, ugly wounds. The Israelis had better tone down their actions before they generate more anti-Semitism.
All right. Thanks very much, Eric. You're the best.
You're welcome, Scott.
EricMargulies.com, y'all. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show. So Eric was in a hurry, had another appointment, had to go. So here, Ayman Mo Yeldin is the, he's Ayman M on Twitter, and he's the NBC reporter reporting here. And, you know, I don't know, man. I wanted to begin this segment talking about Eric is right that Hamas really is stupid for continuing to fire these rockets and being anything but, you know, easy when it comes to agreeing to any kind of ceasefire. Elected or half a coup or whatever the hell. And no, I don't think that they should have to settle for a complete and total siege forever, but there's got to be another way. And any time they can get the Israelis to stop shooting for a minute, they should go along. But, man, compared to Israel bombing a hospital and a playground at a refugee camp, another hospital and another hospital and another hospital. What are they doing? What is this? You know, even with Google Maps and all that crap, I could see people making mistakes sometimes. But this is not accidental. When they're attacking refugee camps and then attacking the hospitals? Where the survivors, where the wounded are going? I mean, this is... Yeah, it's horrible. And, you know, I don't know. It's good business if you're the national security state. In Israel or in America, I guess. But for the rest of humanity, this is just absolutely outrageous. It's ridiculous. MJ Rosenberg tweeted out this morning, "Hey, check all your editorial pages. You'll notice the only people who are writing in justifying this crap are part of the Israel lobby. Regular people are not into it anymore. Not so much. You can find a few on Twitter." But anyway. And I have to say that, you know, my first principle is the same as you'd hear Ron Paul say about it, is that America shouldn't have anything to do with it. That's what's really, it's the same thing as any other war over any other border in the world. America can't solve it. And things may not be so black and white as to who's in the right and the wrong in the first place anyway. You know, look at the mess between Azerbaijan and Armenia and the little part of Azerbaijan that's inside Armenia, like West Berlin was in East Germany kind of thing. These things can be difficult problems to solve. They can also be simple, too, if people want to be honest and above board and avoid crises at all costs, then they can, you know. But first and foremost, lesson number one here is America should not be taking sides. But, of course, the truth is we have been taking sides. America pays Israel more than $3 billion a year. And as Eric Marlies was explaining, their military is basically a subset of our military. Not that it's useful when we go to war for Israel in the region. We got to keep them out, or it'll make it too obvious what we're doing, as though everybody doesn't already know. We're doing what Ariel Sharon wants. So they don't help in Libya. They don't help in Iraq. They don't help in Iraq the first time. No, please stay out. Saddam Hussein's shooting chemical warheads at Tel Aviv in 1991, and George Bush is saying, stay out of it, stay out of it, stay out of it. Don't fight back. Don't fight back. So that's what useful allies they are. But anyway, the point being, not whether they're really useful allies, the point being, in wars that we shouldn't be fighting anyway, that are mostly fought on their behalf, the point is that they're flying American F-16s and American F-15s, and they're shooting American M-16s. And the whole world knows that. And you got to admit, I mean, bin Laden was smart to say, to argue that America's already at war with basically the entire Islamic world. You would, you know, if you're being honest, you'd argue with the whole world. America's attempting to own the government of every nation on earth. No independence allowed anywhere. You know, that's what they want. Complete hegemony. And, got too distracted by the TV for a minute. Well, let's see. Military Industrial Complex, the Empire. Israel blowing stuff up. Oh, I know. I was working my way around somewhere to the people of the world are witnessing the Israelis killing the Gazans with American weapons, and that's going to end up again generating terrorist attacks against the United States. That was what Bin Laden was smart about, was saying that the Israelis kill us, the dictatorship in Egypt kills us, the dictatorship in Saudi Arabia kills us, the Americans bomb us and blockade us from Saudi Arabia, the Iraqis, the Arabs. And he says, so we got to fight the Americans first, lure them in to fight on our sand, bog them down and bankrupt them and destroy their empire and drive them out. Then we can win our local battles. And so he succeeded in doing that. He scandalized the entire region against the United States 1,000 times more than it already was by getting George Bush to play the big dumb bull. And backing Israel like this to a collectivist like Osama bin Laden is all part of his plan, really. Go ahead and escalate the war. You know, his rotting corpse is extremely patient for achieving his goals. They're not on the let's wrap this whole thing up timetable that the American people are on at all. So from bin Laden's point of view, yeah, it's worth it to cause a giant war and occupation in Afghanistan and Iraq and get even more than 1 million Muslims killed if it's for the greater goal of finally forcing the empire, the American empire, out and giving them a more equal shot at their local enemies, then they're all for it. So continued American support for Israel, and in other words, encouragement for the Israeli government to continue besieging and blasting the Gaza Strip the way they do all the time, is exactly what Osama bin Laden would want. You know, as a short-term tactic, short-term for achieving the long-term goals. He would call it a reasonable sacrifice. You know, like all those Sunnis who got drill holes in their brains from the Bada Brigade in Iraq in the war that Osama gave Bush the excuse for. It's all just a means to an end. Anand Gopal, the renowned, if you don't know him, he writes for the Wall Street Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, as a reporter, not the Wall Street Journal editorial page, as a reporter. He's great. And he reported on a letter from bin Laden, talked about it on the show, a letter from bin Laden to Mullah Omar saying, I'm sorry, honestly, this is worse than I thought it would be. However, just wait 10 years and you'll see. We're going to bog them down. We're going to bleed them to bankruptcy. We're going to force their sorry asses out of here. And yes, many of us will die in the meantime, and including even maybe ourselves, but it's still okay. That was what he said to Mullah Omar. Sorry for getting your government overthrown, buddy. But don't worry. We'll be back, and this will end up playing out just like I said, even though it started out a little rougher than I had anticipated, that kind of thing. So, again, this is how to motivate the terrorist war against the United States. Back Israel. You know, when George Bush, I forget at which state, well, let me Google the date on it. Let's see. Sharon, Iran, Syria, Libya. Well, you got to spell Libya, right, idiot? Next. And then, so this would have been, February 2003. So a month before the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu's mentor, Ariel Sharon, said the U.S. should also disarm Iran, Libya, and Syria. Regime change. Go to war. Render them clean, broken. And so, and you know what's funny about this to me is that, you know, I was always criticized when I was a little kid at not putting myself in other people's shoes, so try to be good about that now. So I put myself in the neocon's shoes, and David Wormser's shoes, and Ariel Sharon's shoes, and I could see the argument from their point of view for a clean break, circa 1996. But after the Iraq War and the creation of Jihadistan in western and northwestern Iraq, this is still the policy? Overthrow the secular dictators? You can't adjust at all from that? Are you sure that this is the right thing to do for your security, guys? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And so maybe this is a bad way to start a segment, but Max Fisher over at Vox.com has a thing about, well, just who kidnapped these kids and whether Hamas did it and this and that. And as you may know, over the weekend, a BBC reporter named John Donison and a BuzzFeed reporter named Shira Frinkle both tweeted that the Israeli police spokesman, Mickey Rosenfeld, had admitted to them that, yeah, it was a lone cell. In essence, a Hamas breakoff group, not under the control of the, you know, Hamas Central or whatever. Who did the kidnapping, and that Benjamin Netanyahu knew that all along, of course, and yet he decided to just blame Hamas in general. Now, that part isn't really in dispute. He came right out and said, oh, Hamas is responsible, and they will pay, and that kind of thing, obviously leading people to believe that, yeah, it was Hamas did it. In general, you know, quote unquote, and so therefore, any and all of them were up for grabs. Now, it was obvious at the time that it made no sense when they were just trying to form a coalition government with Fatah, and they're, you know, signing on to all the things that Fatah had agreed to do in negotiations with the Israelis, basically. It made no sense that they would have done that right then, and they denied that they did it. And anyway, so Fisher, I think, kind of sets up a straw man and says, well, so then the question is whether Netanyahu just meant to do this entire war on the Gaza Strip all along. And, you know, but that doesn't have to really be the case. And I'm not sure he's really quoting anyone saying that. He says, you know, the thing escalated and escalated. But he admits in there that as part of the so-called response to Hamas, the Israelis not only rounded up basically all of the Hamas leadership in the West Bank at all, but also killed six with bombs, with airstrikes in Gaza before the rockets. So he admits that. He said, or not even admits it. He says it in a critical way, but he doesn't incorporate that into whether at that point, perhaps, we're not doing mind reading here. We're saying perhaps, whether perhaps the reason that Netanyahu bombed the Gaza Strip was in order to provoke a rocket attack in response so that he could say, look, everyone, history begins on June the 7th. Or July the 7th, pardon me. Instead of acknowledging the fact that they had started bombing Gaza first. At that point, wasn't that maybe the provocation? At that point, he decided he wanted a war in the Gaza Strip. Otherwise, who was he killing? Just six guys that he wanted to kill. They clearly were not involved in the kidnapping whatsoever. And, you know, there was that story in Al-Monitor that was a very kind of in-depth background on the two prime suspects in the kidnapping of the three settler teens, kidnapping and murder of the three settler teens. And they're not connected to Hamas, not really. Shira Frinkle from BuzzFeed tweeted out that Israeli intelligence, in fact, Jeffrey Goldberg, the enforcer, said, oh yeah, well, are they Hamas or are they not Hamas? No, on Twitter. And she said, Israeli intelligence tells me that as far as they know, these guys were connected to Hamas 8 years ago. And that's all they got. They concede. One pro-Israel troll told me, well, that's not a credible source. Right. The spokesman for the Israeli police is not a credible source when he's admitting to a big fake casus belli. That's when he becomes not credible, according to those who support Israel's war against Gaza. The killing. It's a killing, said Eric Margolies. It's not a war. It's a killing. Going on in the Gaza Strip. Absolutely, Netanyahu used the kidnapping of these three boys as a pretext for war. And pardon me, it was obvious all along that he just wanted to blame Hamas and therefore did. That was it. That was his calculation of whether he was going to blame Hamas or not was, do I want to blame Hamas? Yes, I think I do want to blame Hamas. Hamas is responsible, he said. And then broke the ceasefire and started attacking them. So, I know, amazing, right? Those who would deliberately target children for exploding to death would also be dishonest about their reasons for doing so. But, you know, for me, that's important. The dishonesty is important. Not just because it reveals that, hey, why do you think they're lying to you? It's because what they're doing is wrong. They need you to believe these lies so that you won't get mad at them for it. You know, that's the whole thing. But not only that, but for me, it's the insult to injury. And this is a character flaw of mine. I ought to be a hell of a lot more worked up about dead people than me personally being lied to. But oh, I hate being lied to. I hate it. Stop lying to me and telling me errant Hamas missiles hit the hospital that I know you bombed, you lying hospital bomber, killer, murderer, liars. Stop lying about who kidnapped those boys. We can all see right through you. I've been telling these Hasbrous on Twitter, you guys just keep on typing, man. If I'm being generous, I say you ought to just stay home and forget it. Just stick to killing and leave the PR to, I don't know, somebody else. Because your PR sucks. Nobody believes that Israel is accidentally killing all these kids when they're killing so many kids. Targeting a playground, huh? Oh, I guess the leader of Islamic Jihad must have been hiding under the monkey bars, huh, guys? No, you are child killers and liars. Oh, that's why. Oh, yeah, it must have been a Hamas rocket went off course. Yeah, oh, okay. Come on, everybody, let's pretend to believe that for even a moment. How's that fitting? You like that? Does that work for you? It must have been Hamas that bombed the monkey bars. Oh, you know, monkey bars, that's where Al-Qaeda trains. We all know about the evil jihadist monkey bars. I see. So later on when they change their story again, it'll be, well, they were Al-Qaeda monkey bars. And they were also, you know, practicing spin kicks. And that kind of thing. Monkey bar practice. Pole vaulting. Ask Hamid Hayat. He'll tell you all about Al-Qaeda pole vaulting contests. It's a big, important part of their training, you understand. All right. Now, let me talk about the ceasefires here. I do want to say this. I mentioned it before, but I only mentioned it in order to really change the subject, something much more important. But this is important. And that is this article by Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Hamas faces criticism for rejecting Israel's unilateral ceasefire. And what's funny about it is he doesn't cite anybody, because you know who's criticizing him? Jason is. And I say, good. That's absolutely within Jason's authority as news director of antiwar.com, I promise. Hamas faces criticism from Jason Ditz for rejecting Israel's unilateral ceasefire. Hamas reluctant to back any deal that doesn't end blockade. And let me say, I'm absolutely sympathetic to that. And, you know, I saw on CNN this morning, the guy said not Hamas, but just regular people of Gaza are willing to, they are saying, yes, we are willing to go ahead and keep the resistance going such as it is and keep dying in this thing rather than capitulate now and go back to the status quo of the blockade, which they seem to all be calling a living death. Understandably enough. However, it's the responsibility of Hamas, again, to take every opportunity to get Israel to stop shooting. And so they suck for not doing that. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. This is so funny, man. I keep seeing this. Oh, it's admitted in Snowden documents that Israeli Mossad trained Baghdadi of the Islamic State. Really? Yeah, click the link and it takes you to GulfNews.com, which somehow doesn't provide the supposed Snowden document in question. Funny, this has absolutely nothing to do with the National Security Agency at all. Funny, this has absolutely no context, no connection to Edward Snowden whatsoever. And no one else with any Snowden documents is saying, yeah, exactly. And that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Give me a break. I guess people believe whatever they want to believe. Now, it is true that the Israeli government would rather have Baghdadi running around than Nasrallah, according to Michael Oren, because, hey, Nasrallah's backed by Iran. And so they're worse. And if anybody doesn't think that's a big part of why America has... making sure I got all my double and triple negatives in order here. If anybody doesn't think that's a big part of why America's been backing the Mujahideen against Hezbollah / Assad in Syria last few years, well, then you need to go back and read some antiwar.com stuff, I guess. Is the Israeli government in great part responsible for this entire catastrophe? Oh, yeah. I don't think anybody wants to deny that. Let's get a fact straight. Edward Snowden did not leak any documents whatsoever to gulf-news.com. They didn't publish any documents. Where are the documents? He did not leak any documents to them, and certainly nothing to do with anybody training ISIS or anything like that. I don't think so. And as soon as I hear that from Glenn Greenwald, then I'll begin to take it seriously. Okay, back to Gaza real quick here. Stephen Zunis writes Ted Snyder today at antiwar.com. Stephen Zunis, professor of politics and coordinator of Middle Eastern studies at the University of San Francisco, says that a previously proposed framework under which the Palestinians agreed to make major concessions was rejected by Israel. Among the terms of that framework, Israel would recognize a Palestinian state based on pre-1967 borders with mutual adjustments. The Palestinian state would demilitarize. Palestine would give up the right of return, that is, to Israel proper, quote-unquote, in exchange for international assistance in helping refugees to resettle, that is, refugees in Syria, Jordan, etc., to resettle in the new Palestinian state, and Israeli troops would remain at border crossings between Palestine and its Arab neighbors until international forces replace them. Holy crap. Now, you're talking about the Palestinians giving up a lot there when they're the ones who've been occupied for 47 years. Giving up the right of return. I mean, that's huge. For them to be willing to do that in exchange for a little help settling in what's left of the West Bank. But no, complete capitulation is not good enough. And, you know, everyone always says, oh, Hamas, it says in their charter that they do not recognize Israel's right to exist. That's true, except every Hamas leader out loud says, yes, of course we do. And they've said that in writing multiple times and during negotiations and this, that, the other thing. Not only on the Charlie Rose show, but yes, also on the Charlie Rose show. Yes, 67 borders. That's why Netanyahu had to move the goalposts and say it's a Jewish state. Cry uncle, say uncle, and had to try to change the subject from Hamas saying the same thing that the PLA said back in 1988, which is, yeah, sure, we'll recognize Israel's right to exist if you'll let us have our own little territory in the West Bank and Gaza. Let us keep what we have left. But, you know, it's in the Likud Party's charter that all of the West Bank belongs to Israel. Greater Israel. It's called Judea and Samaria to them. It's their promised land. According to a bunch of atheist communists who didn't believe in God, but who said that, yeah, we want to steal this from the people who live there, and so let's pretend that we do for the sake of argument for a minute. And say that, yeah, all that belongs to us too, because it's magic. And so the people who were ethnically cleansed out of what we now call Israel into the West Bank and Gaza, and the people who already live there, and, you know, the descendants of the refugees, at some point, according to Likud, they've all got to go. They're sure as hell not going to allow an Arab majority in a single one state that rules over all of Judea and Samaria. So they're either going to all have to drop dead or go take a long swim in the Jordan River. I guess there's one bridge across into Jordan. But that's in the Likud founding documents. That's in their party platform. And Netanyahu's entire coalition is to the right of him. The Israel our home and the Israeli home and the home of Israel and the home party and all of this is our home and get the hell because we're going to bulldoze your home party. They're all the coalition of right-wing nationalist expansionists who in no way recognize Palestine's right to exist. And Netanyahu just said the exact thing the other day. In fact, I think this is in the same article, isn't it? I read so damn much now. I can't keep it straight anymore, guys. I used to be so good at keeping it all straight. But anyway, I thought maybe the quote was here. But we talked about last week. I read you the quote already on the show last week. Of Benjamin Netanyahu saying that it's impossible and it will never happen that Israel will relinquish security control of any of the territory west of the Jordan River. That means all of the West Bank. It's already de facto annexed territory. It's not even occupied territory. It's just that the Israeli citizens who live there are 1,000th class citizens. That's what it is. It's already, as the Leverets wrote, hey, count them up, guys. According to American State Department statistics, if you count up all the Arab Christians and Muslims in the Golan Heights, inside 67 borders Israel, the Israeli Arab citizens, in the Golan Heights, in the occupied West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem, they're already the majority. It's already a minority apartheid situation. And yes, it's true that the Israeli Arabs are allowed to vote, the citizens of Israel. But of course, those in the Golan Heights, West Bank, Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem may not have no representation whatsoever. To them, especially in the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, I don't know so much about the Golan Heights right now, but in those three territories, they're under a foreign country's permanent occupation, like Baghdad under America 6 years ago. Only for 47 years in a row, longer than the Soviet Union occupied Eastern Europe. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world, all specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. All right, man, I got a lot of news to cover. I've just been moralizing and going on. Well, you know how I am. I'm sorry. I'm going to get back to covering a lot of the news here in a minute, but I got to take a break to interview Jason Ditz from news.antiwar.com about this very important story. It's not specifically, well, it's sort of along the lines of Iraq news, I guess, but it's not specifically tied up with any of our three major conflicts we're covering right now. But it's the top headline on antiwar.com. Obama seeks to dramatically broaden U.S. war on terror. Ending AUMF aims to push a new, vaguer version. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. So, yeah, it's a strange thing. I hadn't talked with you about this, but I'm sure we both talked with Eric Garris about this, and that is how such huge numbers of members of the House of Representatives, including very many Democrats, voted for this thing to limit Obama's authority to go to war in Iraq late last week, which was, you know, pretty interesting that they would do that. And, you know, pretty great on its face, I think. And I think Eric had speculated to me that Obama had, the White House must have said that was okay to get that many Democrats to vote for it. So wonder what he's going for there. Now he turns around, he wants a broader authorization to use military force, not to replace the authorization that they passed in 2002 to attack Iraq, but to replace the AUMF from right after September 11th. And I guess, so then that's supposed to be all-encompassing, even broad enough to include Iraq too? Is that it?
Right. I mean, the problem from the Obama perspective with the 2001 AUMF, the 9/11 one, is that it mentions 9/11 and it authorizes them to go after people that were involved in 9/11, which at this point is 13 years ago. You know, that's quite a long time, and a lot of these various flavor of the week terrorist groups that the Obama administration's got designs on going after didn't even exist back then. So arguing that they were somehow tangentially involved in 9/11 is going to be a tough sell. So instead, he's looking to revise the AUMF with a lot of vague words about terrorism instead of targeting one specific incident of terror.
Mm-hmm. So, well, it's interesting that they think they even need to bother, really. But I guess, so, now that Bush and Obama's policies all this time have changed Al-Qaeda from a group of a couple of hundred guys into a movement of a few thousand around the world, they want basically authorization to kill any Sunni male with a rifle anywhere in the world, and any kids and anybody else who happens to be nearby. Is that basically what they're doing here?
Basically what they're doing, and I'm sure it's going to go broader than just Sunnis. It'll eventually cover, I'm sure, you know, terrorists of any stripe or anything that they can even conceivably get the terrorist label to stick to, whether it's rebels in random other countries that have nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or just whatever wars they might want to start. They want to have this AUMF basically cover anything.
Right. Which, you know, again, it's funny because why bother, you know? They didn't have authorization to do Libya. They just kept right on anyway.
Yeah, that is kind of the one curious thing about this, is that the administration has constantly insisted and continues to insist they don't really need congressional authorization to go to war. And, you know, in the case of Libya, they complied with the part of the law that requires them to inform Congress when they send troops overseas, but they didn't comply with the part where they have to get congressional authorization within so many days after it happens.
Right.
They basically just argued, well, you know, it's done now, we're in it, and...
Yeah, well, and in fact, they had their little controversy where some of the Congress, they tried to pass a thing to repeal it. They couldn't pass that. Then, I think, if I remember it right, they were going to try to pass an authorization, but they didn't have the vote. So instead, they just went to recess. This is like, what, June, July, 2011. And then when they came back, they said, oh, debt ceiling. And no one ever heard of Libya ever again until, you know, we came, we saw, he died, ha, ha, ha.
Right, and the administration used a lot of flimsy arguments on the Libya thing. They tried to argue that because most of what the U.S. was doing in Libya was refueling other NATO members' planes, that doesn't technically count as being involved in the war. Then there was also, well, it's a NATO operation, and because the U.S. is a member of NATO, they're obliged to get involved, even though there were other NATO members that weren't involved.
So under this new authority, you think they could attack, I don't know, say, resistance fighters in eastern Ukraine even, something that has no conceivable connection to bin Ladenites in any case?
Oh, absolutely. I think wording it that broadly is the ultimate goal here, because, of course, the Ukrainian government has been calling eastern Ukraine terrorists and calling their attacks on eastern Ukrainian cities an anti-terror operation for a month now. And I think the U.S. would very much like to get that model in place to use themselves.
Yeah. Man, this is really amazing. I the only article, I guess, well, let me see what you're linking to here in yours. I saw, yeah, you got the Free Beacon. I saw something at Politico. Yeah, you got the link to the Politico, too. I didn't see any other coverage of this, but this is the hugest thing in the whole world. I mean, this is what Bush wouldn't dare have said to Congress, even right after 9/11, that, in fact, I guess he did try to do this. And Daschle and Gephardt made him take this stuff out, where the AUMF would be broad enough to go ahead and attack any country that they wanted. You want to go to Iraq, you got to come back to us, they said. And that was, you know, after Bush had all the political capital of a 90% approval rating from the biggest failure of any American president in all of our history. And so if he didn't have the capital to get away with it then, think of how far we've come where it's not even really big news except at antiwar.com and kind of right-wing, kind of fringe even right-wing, you know, free republic-ish type places where they would criticize Obama's executive power rather than just celebrating it like you'd get at the National Review, you know?
All right. I think people are very much used to the idea now that the president is the commander-in-chief and therefore can just start wars whenever he wants to. I think the administration's been very successful in selling that idea.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, we talked about this before about, you know, to what degree the average American thinks of this current era as peacetime, you know, if not around the world, at least here, you know, we're not involved in any of this stuff. All that was the Bush years. That's all over. They don't even realize how up to our eyeballs, quote unquote, we are in this stuff going on right now all around the world. Anyway. So let's talk more about Ukraine. As you said, they've been labeling all the fighters in eastern Ukraine. Oh, now the music's going to start playing here in a minute, Jason. When we get back, everybody, with the great Jason Ditz from antiwar.com, news.antiwar.com, I'm going to ask him all about what the hell is going on in Ukraine. Plenty of civilian casualties to report on from that new offensive breaking out. And... you know, something tells me all this distraction with Gaza and Iraq, we're really ignoring the most important thing, which is America's border dispute with Russia right now. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all, I'm Scott. This is my show. I got Jason Ditz on the line from news.antiwar.com. News.antiwar.com. And so now we got to go through the Ukraine stuff here. I guess, can we start with the plane? Jason, here's my thing about it. Seems like Occam's razor is rebels must have shot it down for some reason. Maybe even, this is just my imagination. I don't know. I haven't done the work. Maybe the Ukrainian military kind of baited them into it. And then, you know, flew away and left the civilian plane vulnerable, something. I don't know. Maybe they thought they were hitting a military plane and they screwed up and they, yeah. But then again, it seems like all the people saying that it had to have been the rebels, and never even mind that, oh, yeah, and Putin must have helped them do it and all that kind of stuff, which is, I think, a lot more obviously kind of a red herring sort of thing. But it seems like all the so-called accusations and confirmations that the rebels even did it, the government keeps climbing down from all those things, especially in that one big so-called intelligence briefing, last Thursday or Friday, whatever it was. So I just wonder what you think is going on here, man. Is it possible the Kiev government actually really did this thing? Or I don't know.
It's possible. I think there's a lot we still don't know about it, and unfortunately, a lot that people don't seem particularly interested in finding out about what really happened. The minute that plane went down, it seems like everybody got their fingers crossed, hoping they could blame it on somebody convenient, which in the U.S. case would be Russia, and Ukraine's case was initially the rebels, but then was also Russia. And in Russia's case was the Ukrainian military. I think everybody just sort of went, oh, this is a great diplomatic opportunity to sort of parlay this into some sort of advantage.
Right. Bastards all around. It's unbelievable. It's shooting down a plane full of 300 civilians. And yeah, you're right. I mean, they even said, yeah, this could be a game changer. Yeah, nice. What a fun game you're playing. But so, can you go through a little bit of the you know, kind of accusations about, you know, which side claims, which satellite photos show what, and which of any of those kinds of assertions have held up, that kind of thing, and help us understand where we're at with the argument, at least?
Well, among the claims, there's very little that was very concrete. We had some videos that were released by the Ukrainian government. There was some pretty strong evidence that one of the videos, which claimed to show some intercepted phone calls between Russia and the rebels, were actually doctored footage of a previous phone call that they started a day before the plane even went down. And the U.S., the State Department has been insane on this. When they get asked about this during their daily press briefing, they're always just referring people to social media. That's become their new buzzword, is that, oh, there's all sorts of evidence on social media if you press types would care to look at it. And
which is like saying, hey, listen, I didn't make it up. I heard it somewhere, at least. Okay? So.
Right. It's on Facebook or it's on YouTube or wherever. And
nobody knows where the original tweet came from, but look at all these retweets. There must be something to it, Jason.
And when the intelligence community was asked to put forward their evidence, they admitted, basically, we have nothing. There's a plane that got shot down. There's pretty good evidence it was shot down. We don't know who fired the missile. We don't know who they were affiliated with, what their nationality was, anything like that. a pretty good idea it's a missile and a pretty good idea of what type of missile it was, but beyond that, there's just a lot they don't know. And
do you know of any real reason to believe that the rebels had that kind of weapon?
It's a curious thing, and I think it makes Ukraine and the U.S. government look a lot worse than they realize, because throughout this war, the rebels were constantly being talked about as having these shoulder-fired man-pad-type missiles that only go up to 5-10,000 feet max. And when Ukraine put forward the idea, you can still fly over that area, but you have to fly at over 30,000 feet. So civilian aircraft were still cleared to go through there. Now there's all these claims that, you know, first there were claims that the rebels had looted one of these vehicle-fired anti-aircraft missiles from the Ukrainian government, and there were claims that, oh no, the Russians sent these into Ukraine, and we knew about it weeks ago, but for some reason, whatever the case, if the rebels did get this weapon weeks ago, as is claimed by all these stories, neither the Ukraine nor the U.S. government, which both claim to know about it, ever told anybody, and they were still letting planes through this corridor on the idea that, oh, all the rebels have is these shoulder-mounted missiles that can't hit you if you're flying that high.
Yeah, you know, it's hard sometimes to make all your different lies line up with what's known otherwise to be true, you know?
But, right, and if the rebels did have these weapons, and the U.S. government and Ukraine just chose to keep that a secret,
then they put those people at risk, yeah.
That's a pretty serious problem.
Right. Yeah, more likely they didn't, I think. They're just bluffing. But yeah, you're right, in either case, it does look pretty bad for them. Now, okay, so let's talk about the current offensive that's going on now. Do you have any kind of sense of the balance of power there on the ground in Donetsk now, and if the momentum is with the offensive from the West?
The momentum definitely seems to be with the offensive from the West. Donetsk itself still is pretty securely in rebel hands. There are some other cities in the surrounding area that the rebels control, but not as securely. Another thing that isn't getting much coverage is, despite the Ukrainian military promising a ceasefire in the, I forget if it's 30 or 40 kilometers surrounding the plane crash site, the military was openly sieging the plane crash site itself today and bragging about having seized part of the crash site.
That's interesting.
Yeah, they're openly fighting over the smoldering wreckage of MH17.
Have they even gotten all the bodies yet, or that's still in progress, or there's no one in charge, I guess? Hadn't been.
Yeah, they've gotten most of the bodies, but I think there are still some unaccounted for, a few dozen. And the black boxes, of course, have been gotten out of there and everything, so I'm not really sure what the strategic value of controlling the plane site is anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, I saw this. They've been talking about the Russians sending in more heavy equipment. Have they provided any evidence of that?
No, not at all.
You know, it sounded to me, I got to tell you, just the way that they put it, it sounded like they were trying to fill in the gap in their missile story by just sort of saying, yes, the Russians are sending more weapons into the rebels kind of thing, you know, implying, you know, like those missiles last week, but without exactly trying to say that.
Well, and the State Department, once again, was at the forefront of this allegation, although the Pentagon also sort of piled on. And it led to a pretty funny exchange at the State Department briefing, because spokeswoman Mary Harf presented this, said she wasn't going to give any evidence for it, and when she was pressed on how you could believe it when there was no evidence, she got really huffy with the reporters and asked if they just wanted her to not tell them important information if she couldn't back it up with evidence.
Yeah, I saw, my favorite quote out of that was, "Do you have a YouTube or anything you could show us?" All deadpan. That was great. All right, now, can you talk to me about NATO? Oh, man, we're almost out of time. Real quick, they're doing some kind of NATO exercises in Poland, is that right?
Yeah, they've been doing these sort of off and on over the last couple of months. It seems like, you know, there are always war games in Eastern
Is there much
Europe
of a build-up that's going along with that, or still pretty slow?
It's pretty slow, but they keep doing these exercises just sort of to emphasize the fact that they're putting forces in the area.
Right. All right, well, we got to go. Thanks so much, Jason. Appreciate it, bud.
Sure, thanks for having me.
That's the great Jason Ditz already, news.antiwar.com. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the Off Now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in. Coming up, still Joshua Hughes from, I think, Costa Rica? I forget. I better check that email he wrote. Anyway, we're getting to that. Right now, it's going around on Twitter, and a friend just sent it to me. This interview with the son of one of the founders of Hamas, saying that, oh, they'll stop at nothing. They don't want to just destroy Israel. They want to take over the whole world. And so, you know, for all I know, this is the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador in drag kind of a thing. Who knows who this kid really is? I don't know. But assume for the sake of argument that it's legit what this, who the guy is and what he's saying, hates his father and is telling the West all about him. I believe every word of it. I mean, assuming who he is, that he's the son of one of the founders of Hamas, and he has all this mad stuff to say about them, I believe any accusation he's got, basically, about any horrors that they commit upon the people of Palestine, you know, any war crimes, any accusations he's got, and as far as what they say about what tough guys they are and their ultimate goals in the world and all that kind of thing, I wouldn't doubt that either. But I think it's important to note, for the sake of the argument that's taking place here, that Hamas doesn't have any power at all. Look, most weapons that they have are the weapons that Elliot Abrams gave them when, after they won the election of 2006 and still had to form a coalition government with Fatah, that's the more pro-American Israel sock puppet types, the Americans, Elliot Abrams and the Pentagon, in league with Ehud Olmert and Hosni Mubarak, funneled a bunch of weapons to Fatah in the Gaza Strip to attack Hamas and drive them out of power completely. And of course, it just backfired and blew up in their face, and all they ended up doing was giving them a bunch of guns. The rockets that they have now, I guess some of them are professional grade, but mostly they're homemade rockets, and they're completely ineffectual. They haven't killed a single person with a rocket yet that they've fired out of there. And so, in other words, yeah, they're scumbags, but so... I don't think anybody, I haven't seen anybody on all of Twitter and all of the media and all of the news, I haven't heard anybody say, poor old Hamas, those guys are all right. Nobody's saying that. Everyone who is taking the side of the people of Palestine, that is, you know, the prisoners of the Gaza Strip in this case, the civilian men, women, and children there, oftentimes are very critical of Hamas, for their bad tactics and strategy in answering violence with violence. And, you know, I would concede that anyone in Gaza has a right to defend themselves. Every human being has the right to defend themselves, and that's a fact. Doesn't mean it's always the best strategy, as a lot of nonviolent peace activists in the past have proven. But then again, you know, the Israelis seem hell-bent on proving to the Palestinians that peaceful protests will get you nowhere. So, you know, it's not like anybody is around the world is rallying to their cause. As long as they have America, the people are, but no government will. As long as America's in their corner, there's no real pressure on them to concede. But anyway, so, you know, Hamas is a right-wing religious group. It started out as a charity, and then the Israelis helped encourage it. Again, you can read Andrew Higgins in the Wall Street Journal, and you can read Richard Sale in UPI. You can also read in Robert Dreyfus's book, The Devil's Game. No, not the, just Devil's Game, how the U.S. helped to unleash fundamentalist Islam. And you can find out all about how the Israelis thought it'd be a great idea to encourage the rise of this right-wing religious alternative to the, you know, more or less secular commie PLO. Let's create, you know, a right-wing political movement to counter the left and to divide the Palestinians. And so, you know, that's how Hamas came to be a terrorist group in the first place. Came to be an organization that even really took stands on politics in the first place. And then, yes, in the Second Intifada, and I don't know their entire history, but I know in the Second Intifada they deliberately targeted women and children with suicide bombers and this kind of, you know, most sickening kind of thing. I remember them blowing up pizza parlors full of kids and that kind of thing. And that may not have all been Hamas, but they were certainly in on that, and they certainly have used horrifying terrorist tactics against civilians in the past. But then again, I do think that's been a number of years now. And the fact that they've even participated in elections means that they have decided they're playing the damn game then. They think, or they at least in the past have thought, that there's a chance if they play the damn game and run for the election and participate in the process and make their concessions and ally with Fatah in the West Bank and create some kind of coalition and go along with the negotiations, that eventually they'll get some kind of rump state and some kind of power sharing with Fatah in the rump state, the Palestinian state. So they've... In fact, that was what was going on with them signing on with Fatah in the first place in the coalition government. Benjamin Netanyahu, of course, said, oh, yeah, you know, framed it as though the Fatah and the PLO and the government of the West Bank, that they were basically going now under the Hamas fold and adopting whatever Hamas's positions are and everything. But it was the exact opposite case. They were signing on to what are supposedly the official positions of the Palestinian Authority, not the Fatah faction that happens to rule it, if you understand what I mean. In other words, they were playing the game more. That was what pissed Benjamin Netanyahu off so much. That's why he exploited the kidnapping and murder of those three boys, was to take the opportunity to drive a wedge again between Fatah and Hamas and try to, you know, nip their coalition government in the bud, since obviously the peace talks haven't worked out. And according to the consensus over there at the National Interest and whatever, I guess I haven't read Foreign Affairs about it, but apparently the consensus among the foreign policy establishment is that was it. John Kerry's last shot at a two-state solution falling apart there, that was the last time anybody's going to ever pretend that they're ever going to really achieve that. That was it. And so, they formed the coalition government at the end of the peace talks falling apart in order to, I guess, go the UN General Assembly route and try to sign up for as many organizations as they can and get recognized by more and more of the world as an independent state and see if that increases their bargaining position for later, basically. That's what they were doing. But again, the Hamas, just as well as Fatah, the entire Palestinian Authority, recognize that they don't have any chance of having a state at all if their official position is that they mean to destroy Israel. They are the ones who are the prisoners here. The Israelis hold all the cards. The Palestinians hold none of them. In case, you know, American TV got that screwed around for you there about who has the power and who is helpless in this situation. So, you know, that's as good of a defense of the Hamas position anyway. I'd never defend those people. But that's the position that they're in. It's not really a defense either. It's just a description of the what they're doing. They're trying to play the political game, and Israel's game is making them learn that that's hopeless. To what end? I don't know. Because, you know, here's the, it probably wasn't Dempsey. It was a top Pentagon official, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, the outgoing head of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, warned that if you destroyed Hamas, that would only lead to something more dangerous taking its place. Remember, it was just, may have been even 2 years ago now, when there was an al-Qaeda-type group pop their head up in Gaza, and Hamas attacked them and killed the hell out of them, just killed them, wiped them out. A few dozen people, anyway. Said, nice little pro-Zawahiri mosque you got here, now you're dead. They tolerate none of that. Is that what? Maybe that is what Netanyahu would prefer. Then he could just kill everybody under the excuse they're all, part of ISIS after Hamas is out of the way. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, hey, you guys, I'm me. Welcome back to my show here. So, horrible fighting going on in Libya. I had one invite out to a Libya guest today. I meant to send out a couple of more. Very soon, hopefully tomorrow, I'll have somebody great on about liberty, the lack of it. About the 50-sided civil war raging there. Oh, what a humanitarian mission that was, huh? All right, and sorry. Don't have anybody to cover that for us. No expert guest today, but soon. Talked about that already. Oh, this is important. Company in which Joe Biden's son is director prepares to drill shale gas in East Ukraine. I mean, this is just amazing to me. Really, Joe Biden's son, the vice president's son. You don't even get his best friend from when he was a kid or his second cousin or somebody to fill in. You send the vice president's son to directly profit on a coup d'etat and a civil war on just outright stealing oil. I mean, this is crime of Cheneyite proportions going on. What in the world? How can they do this? I don't mean how can they be so terrible, but I mean how can they get away with it? How can it be so blatant? The vice president's son. They put him on the board of directors of a Ukrainian oil company in the middle of a civil war. Let me guess. You were having problems with the previous government? I can't believe it. I'm sorry. It's just incredible to me. It's the kind of thing where it's like that story I mentioned earlier where, oh yeah, Baghdadi is a sock puppet of the Israelis. Yeah, right. Show me your footnotes. That's ridiculous. That couldn't possibly be true. Come on. What do you mean the vice president's son is now post-coup on the board of directors of this company gonna pull a bunch of oil out of the ground? A bunch of money. I'm sorry. This is the fun part of my job, I guess. I'm talking about dead Gazan babies all morning. Hey, look, everybody, the vice president's son. is on the board of directors of this new oil company in coup d'etat, Ukraine. Let's see here. This is from Zero Hedge. Recall what we said earlier today. The proxy Ukraine war is just like that in Syria preceding it. It's all about energy. Well, I think that's not quite the case, but still. Recall also the following chart showing Ukraine's shale gas deposits, keeping in mind that the Dnieper Donets Basin, which I just mispronounced, which lies in the hotly contested eastern part of the nation, where, as everyone knows by now, a bloody civil war is raging, is the major oil and gas producing region of Ukraine, accounting for approximately 90% of Ukrainian production, according to EIA, whatever that is, may have 42 TCF. Come on, brain, figure out what that stands for real quick. No? Okay. Of shale gas resources technically recoverable from 197 TCF of risked shale gas in place. And then recall our story from May that Joe Biden's son, Hunter, isn't that cute, just joined the board of the largest Ukraine gas producer, Burisma Holdings. I love that mugshot of him, too. Boy, is he pleased with, you know, whatever's happening with him that day. They took that picture. God dang, what a happy boy. Old Hunter Biden. I'm rich, he seems to be saying in this picture. Wow. I'm not saying that was the reason for the coup in the first place, but I am saying something like that, right? I don't know. You know, in the broader sense, this is what it comes down to, man. Everybody's an individual. Everybody's got their interests. We might not even know the real force behind keeping us in Afghanistan this whole time. It might have nothing to do with drugs. It might not have nothing to do with anything we even know about. But a few well-placed people are making a hell of a lot of money doing something around there. I don't know. I mean, yeah, drugs too, but don't get me wrong, but I'm just saying, you never know. But what it all comes down to always is just like Mises says, man acts. Start from there. Even the most loyal somebody is loyal for their own reasons. All right. Anyway, so now, man, I'm almost out of time, and I didn't get to talk about all the crime stuff. There's new NSA stuff. Oh, man. Top journalists and lawyers. NSA surveillance threatens press freedom and right to counsel. This is an emergency. This comes down to the very core of, hey, this is America. Meaning, hey, you can't do that because there are some lines around here that prevent the government from treating us like we're slaves of the German Nazis here. We got rights. This is America. We're allowed to talk to our lawyer without the prosecutor eavesdropping, right? Can we all agree on that? How about reporters got the right to be reporters? Do we have consensus in America for that anymore? Anyway, that's at The Intercept, and there's also another one at The Intercept about how they're working with the Saudis, helping the Saudis crack down on it. That means murder their own people, target their own people. I wanted to point out, where's the article here? About a 17-year-old, which that's pretty old for a kid, but a 17-year-old killed a cop's dog. And apparently the dog's a former K-9 officer and is not even actually a K-9 officer, whatever. The young man was sentenced to 23 years. And I can't find the damn article. I had it here the other day in my police state section for you. But the point being, I've mentioned this over and over and over again about how not only do the cops get away with killing any person that they want, and especially killing any dog that they want, that seems to be a daily occurrence now. If anybody has Facebook or Twitter, you know what I'm talking about. It's in your newsfeed all the time. You can't ignore it. Cop murders dog. Cop murders dog. There's a brand new one this morning. Cop murders dog in front of a 6-year-old girl. I'm not making that up. Look at my Twitter feed. It's right there. I got the link to the story from the local news. Happens all the time. They'll kill your dog and they'll kill you like a dog and they'll get away with it always. They got sovereign immunity. As long as they're on the clock, they can kill any of us. They can just kill us and never get in trouble for it. Never get in trouble for it. And yet, you look at the handful of cases, and there's not many, but you just go and find man convicted for killing K-9 officer or whatever, and you will see people doing decades in prison for killing a cop's dog, because it doesn't matter that's not a human being, it's a police officer. And so people are sentenced as such. And this has happened again, 23 years for killing a dog. Which is all right, but not because it's a cop's dog. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Now, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is Joshua Hughes. Joining us by Skype from the jungles of Costa Rica. Welcome to the show, Joshua. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay, Scott. I'm a little tired, actually, and I kind of have a headache right now, but that's to be expected after a week of not eating.
Yeah, I was going to say, I got an email, everybody, from Joshua last week announcing, well, first of all, explaining that he's a listener to the show, now an American expat down there in Costa Rica living on a farm, and has decided to go on a hunger strike. And exactly what for and for how long?
Well, I should maybe give you a little history about myself first.
Sure.
I used to be involved in corporate America. I lived in Oregon, and I was in the security industry. I helped protect corporations from litigation by shredding all their information, everyone from Enron to Nike to Homeland Security. So I was on that side of the fence for a little while, and I saw too much, and it really sickened me what was going on.
Really? Shredding documents was your specialty?
It was. I was in what started as a small company, and then 9/11 happened, and and the security industry went nuts. And we didn't just militarize the police and everything else. We militarized the garbage, too. And companies started taking that very seriously because they needed to protect themselves from us. So, you know, I was a part of that, and it made me feel really bad once I opened my eyes. The beginning of the Iraq War, I had a child at that time, my first child, my only child. And, man, it really connected me to what was going on, and I tried to make a difference, and I got fired real quick. they really couldn't have anybody on the inside in that business that wanted to make changes happen. So I tried to start affecting change up there, and, man, I got the end of the billy club and the pepper spray more than 100 times. I kind of came to the conclusion that I needed to get back to the basics. So I moved to Costa Rica not just out of a real disdain for power and the bureaucracy that's going on up there in the militarized state. I really needed to start getting down to the brass tacks. I wanted to build infrastructure, get involved in some answers, not just telling people what they shouldn't be doing. So I came down here, and I've really focused on infrastructure building, like I said, and we've had kind of a free school here, helping people learn how to do back to the basics, get into food production, get into building community, doing politics again, getting back involved in local issues. And I have kind of stayed away from this stuff for a while, but this Israeli aggression on Gaza has really fired me up. And last month I actually had an issue with my own child needing an operation, and I just had a few days of scare where I felt like I might lose a child or what that even felt like. And it really, really connected me to the people in Gaza even deeper. And I decided last Monday that I wouldn't take in any calories until this current siege, the bombings from the air, land, and sea, sniper fire, all the things that are going on that you inform listeners of so well. I don't even need to really dive into most of that, but I can't take this anymore. And I don't know what to do to affect the people at the top. I don't think I can, but I know I know this has done something kind of amazing, to be honest. I've had 1,000 people get back to me that care about me. And I'm finding that although they may care about the children in Palestine, people weren't thinking about it personally enough. So I did this to stand up and get those that love me and love their other brothers and sisters in the U.S. to start paying attention to our part in this war. And I read the media, and they say things like John Kerry and Obama say things about how we're not doing enough over there, but we're definitely doing something. We're giving between $500,000 and $1 million an hour in military or support to Israel, military aid or support to Israel to do these things. So we are an active participant. You know that better than most. And I really honor you and thank you for the information you get out there and the amazing guests you have on. I'm more informed all the time by listening to you. You break through that media glass ceiling or whatever that all these other big mass prostitute corporations are telling us. And I can't believe how inactive so many people are in our country about this, but I can believe it when I look at the information they're fed for the last 66 years about this issue.
Yeah. Well, you know, thanks. As far as that goes, I appreciate it. I'm trying. I don't know what any ceilings I'm breaking through here, but to the point, I really understand your frustration because, like I was explaining on the show earlier to the people, I don't know what to do either. That's why I have a radio show, because it's for lack of any better idea, which has always been the way I've thought of it for 15 years and counting now, man. It's the best thing I know how to do. And but,
hey,
you know, I think
the
reason
key.
That hunger strikes are effective a lot of the time. I don't know every time or whatever, but a lot of time they can be very effective because it's very clearly and obviously up front. It's a very serious thing. It takes a lot of commitment, and at least it does, as you're saying, it piques people's curiosity as what
it
could
does.
This guy think is so important that he's willing to do that.
So many people think these issues are like these age-old religious issues. I think that the media wants us to believe that, so these are unanswerable problems. Mm. But these are very answerable things. We can do something about this. We can cut funding. We can stop arming massive militaries that are attacking people that are throwing stones and Molotovs. And I know there's some rockets flying out of Gaza, but you know, you've spoke about this, and I wish people would understand how these things actually unfold, because rockets and these are responses to things. This is a symptom of a disease, not the disease. And I've been hard at work in the infrastructure end here, so a lot of people around me know that I've been committed to creating a viable alternatives, coming up with my own kind of anarchy / socially conscious movement that can give people answers. But I've had too much. I can't watch another 1,000 innocent people and 500 more children and women get blown into pieces without doing something. And you do one of the most important things you can, and that's educate people. I've learned through the thousands of people that have come through our place here that once people start to see what's going on, they can crack the code, so to speak, and right. Then they can see through the media lies and start making sense of it themselves. So yeah, this was something I did not, again, to think I could affect something like Obama or John Kerry or any of these people or Netanyahu. They don't care about me. They don't care about babies. They don't care about old women. They don't care about hospitals. They shot another hospital today with a drone. They shot a playground today in a refugee center, killed 7 children, I think. This isn't something I'm doing to try and make them pay attention. It's something I'm doing to make the people that love me or know me to pay attention. And I tell you, I've done a lot of actions in my life, and this is the one that's gotten the most attention. And I don't feel very good. My body hurts, and my mind isn't as clear as it should be. I'm sorry to rant a little bit,
I was going to say, you sound okay. You're on how many days into this thing now?
Since last Monday afternoon. And I drink a lot of water, and I have healthy, beautiful water where I live. But and I actually haven't felt hunger. I've just felt like a weird, I'm starting to get dizzy. I've been really tired, but I've been conserving energy, so I've kind of kicked back my normal work, my pace of work, and fully committed myself to this issue right now and educating people. And I've had an interesting week. I've had so many amazing responses from people that are afraid to talk about this issue. And I've spoken about the American war machine for so many years and gotten such wonderful response, even from people that don't agree with me politically. But when you talk about Israel, I mean, I've been called a KKK member this week. I can't believe it. How many times I've been called a Nazi. totally backwards, right? And it's an issue that needs to be reframed and talked about in what's in a different way.
Joshua, how are people interacting with you there? You have a website, or that's on Twitter, Facebook, or?
I'm really not a fan of the Facebook world.
Yeah, I quit it too, man.
I haven't been on it for years. I think it's mostly a waste of time, and it's the way the CIA overthrows countries. I have a website. I run for my farm here, and it's mostly just been a way to spread the message of permaculture, which is something I do here as an answer.
Yeah.
But I've turned it pretty much into my political soundboard for the last week.
All right. Well, hold it right there for a minute, and then we'll come back and get more with Joshua Hughes, American expat in Costa Rica, hunger striking for the Gaza. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com. They're one-ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the backside. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity Discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code Commodity Disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's CommodityDiscs.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hitting refresh on antiwar.com here. Latest numbers still 1,139 killed in Gaza so far. I'm on the phone with Joshua Hughes. He's an American expat down in Costa Rica, and he's a week now into a hunger strike for the people of Gaza until the Israeli government finally ceases fire, for this round at least. And so I'm sorry, at the break we were interrupted there, Joshua. I was trying to ask you, how is it that people are communicating with you? You said you've got a lot of great response out of it.
I have.
From your community. Your typical primary focus is on farming and your certain methods and all that, but you have what, forums there, comment sections, what's going on. Is that it?
Yeah, we have a blog on there that normally pays attention to, well, not just farming stuff, but building community, working together, all these things. This is just the macro part of it, and this isn't something that I should ever leave out of my farming anyway, because it affects all of us. We're in a pretty small world when you think about it. Places like things like Fukushima have proven that we're connected. And there's no getting away from the big issues, even if we want to go live in little islands by ourselves. So, but I've gotten a great response from most people. Maybe 99% of the people who have responded to me have told me things like that they didn't have the confidence to talk about this issue because they would get beaten down by people or called racists. Mm-hmm. So I'm having a lot of people feeling that power, that it's okay to stand up about this issue now. And mm-hmm. as long as you talk about it in the right context, you can talk about this. So it's been mostly positive, and I'm doing the parts that the things that I don't even hardly believe in anymore, but begging people to call their congressmen and scream at them and call John Kerry's office and call the media organizations and demand some, equal time at least. We don't need to see Netanyahu for 28 minutes and one Palestinian getting carried out on a stretcher for 1 minute. This isn't working. This isn't framing this issue properly. So I'm begging people to do whatever they can. And I don't have a lot of faith in the democracy we supposedly have anymore. We've been convinced one day every 4 years on a Tuesday is how we make a difference. But, we need to scare our Congress people. We need to make them pay attention to us. And they may get a lot of money from AIPAC, but they're still afraid of us. And we can create movements. So I haven't lost faith in that yet. And, there's a lot of apathy out there, and there's a lot of misinformation. But when it comes to standing up for children that are being blown apart by the highest tech weapons in the world, we should take a moment, and we should tell our congressmen we're paying attention.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. I'm not the biggest believer in the democratic process or anything like that, but I'd be the last person to say it's worthless and that people shouldn't try, because you're right. I mean, AIPAC money buys a lot of TV ads, but it really ultimately comes down to the votes. And like you said before, with just a little bit of access to some real information, people change their minds real quick about what's going on here. I've come to discover more and more, just basically solid in my view now, that virtually everyone who takes the pro-Israel position is living in probably, you know, not willful denial of the fact that there's even an occupation going on. People really do pretend like Palestine is the country next door and it's a fair fight that they've picked here and this kind of thing. And the whole, you know, kindergartner versus Mike Tyson kind of analogy is not applied because they just don't know. No one ever really puts it to them that way and lets them really see, you know, the disparity in power between the two sides and the facts of the siege and this kind of thing. So I think you're right that, you know, ultimately if the American people have access to the truth and they want something done about it, they can get something done about it, you know?
And this is a very difficult issue, right? Because the world has been really set up since World War II, or, you know, like you talk about a lot, since World War I, we drew these lines in parts of the world where we needed to control petroleum. We needed to have access to the resources we needed. And we needed to take whatever we felt necessary so we could feel successful and secure. And those things are coming around. The scale is going to balance. It always will. And it's not going to balance the way that Americans think it will. It's going to bring us all down, not all up. And I you know, I want to put my thumb on the scale in every way I can. And, you know, again, I don't have a lot or hardly any faith in elections anymore. But I do think that we can scare our politicians of us, and they should fear us. They should know that we can take control. There's 7 billion plus people and just a few thousand very powerful people that are doing these things. And things like the Israel, this isn't an accident. It isn't a last moment decision. They must have spent months piling up these rockets and weapons and helicopters and prepping for this. I've heard they were buying weapons as far back as April. And then, you know, so this didn't just happen. And I even read this week from some reputable sources that Israel knew. You've talked about this. They knew that these kids were dead, the first three teenagers that were killed.
Sure.
They knew they were dead pretty much right away. And they knew it wasn't ordered by Hamas pretty much right away. The right. police chief says it wasn't. So, you know, this has all been propaganda to get us into it again. And once we're into it, it's too late. And then, like in Israel, man, people there that are resisting it. There are amazing people in Israel resisting this, and they're being beaten. But you know, it's really insane what's going on over there. Actually, some of my favorite journalists are live in Tel Aviv, and they have bodyguards right now because they're getting threatened by their own. They're not in danger from Hamas. They're in danger from the regular folks in Israel that are whipped up into a lather about this war.
Yeah, there were two buses full of peace activists that were basically blockaded on the road and prevented from attending a peace rally in Tel Aviv, I think, just a few days ago.
And you know, also, there's something that we really need to not miss, and you talk about this a lot, but, you know, we're not talking about a democracy in Israel that they're going for. They're going for a Jewish-only state. What does that mean to people? Do people need to take in what this means? It's what if I said we had a Christian-only United States? That wouldn't make very many people happy. That would scare the hell out of most people. So we need to talk about it in that context too. Yeah. This movement, Israel's movement, hasn't been to create a democracy in the Middle East. If it was, they would let the Arabs and the Palestinians vote that are in their borders. And it wouldn't look like it looks right now. The government would be much more balanced and they wouldn't be able to pull this off. So, you know, Israel isn't the beacon of hope in the democracy in the Middle East. In fact, Hamas is one of the only truly elected governments ever in that part of the world, right? I mean, maybe the second or third ever. So we're helping bomb the only.
Not that
one
it was the
only.
Most open and honest election ever or anything, but yeah, hey, they won it. You're
they
right.
did, and I, you know, I just every time the guys we don't want to win, we call them, you know, we go against them. So. Sure. We need to get this in context is all. And I'm not saying Hamas are my favorite people in the world. I'm about as anti-religious as it gets. But I find myself allied with people that I, you know, that are suffering. And it happens to be people in that part of the world right now that are getting the worst of it. And this is worse than apartheid South Africa. This is like trying to exterminate people. And if you just have to look at the maps. Look at the maps of Israel, of Palestine since 1947. It says it all. You barely need to talk about it once you look at the map of how their country's dissolved and been turned into these cantons, and you can't go from one place to another without going through checkpoints and maybe getting shot or thrown in prison without charge forever. There's thousands of children in jail in Israel without charge. These are real war crimes going on, and the mass media doesn't use those words. And even when they do, they kind of say there might be war crimes unfolding. Like, we need to take a stand on this one on the media. And again, I applaud you and a couple other people. I mean, Democracy Now! Has been spot on this last few weeks. I was pissed off at Amy Goodman when she did the Libya thing, but she's brought me back with this. She's been solid.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. They've done real good work over there. And you know, I mean, come on. If you're like you're saying, any honest appraisal, this thing is just a canned hunt. You know, this is horrible. This is like the New Jersey State Police versus the prisoners of Attica.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a prison. It's an open air prison. Slaughter. It's amazing how out of context this is, and we need to bring it back into context. So I took this opportunity to suffer a little bit myself, and I don't even hardly use that word suffer, but I come from a privileged.
You sound like you're doing pretty good for a week into this thing. I was gonna say, hey, you know, I hope you don't take this too far,
Scott.
Where you know you're really risking your health because you have primary responsibilities to your own, you know.
Well, you know, but my own includes you, and it includes others, and it includes children all over, both in Gaza and Tel Aviv, and I don't want this to lead to the thing it can lead to. I mean, we're pulling in other countries now to try and other countries are trying to bring some resolution to this, but it's like Israel's asking for Iran to get involved. It's like they're asking for Turkey to get involved because they want regional chaos. It keeps the war machine going, and we need to stop that. And I feel. I may sound like I have energy, but trust me, this is really just because I've been excited to spread this message. When this is over, I need to go lay down.
Yeah. And it is over now, but I thank you for your time, Joshua, and I thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you, Scott. Keep up the great work,
brother.
And
it sounds like
it's
working, too. Like you're really getting some positive results out of it, so I really appreciate that, too.
My website is verdenergia.org. verdenergia.org.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you, brother.
All right. That's the show. See y'all tomorrow.